Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Eamon Murphy, Economic and Social Analyst at Social Justice Ireland. Hopefully you and yours are keeping safe and well in these strange and unprecedented times in which we're living. Our podcast series contains a number of recent interviews dealing with the current COVID-19 pandemic, including with Tom McDonnell of the Nevin Economic Research Institute on the economic response to COVID-19, Orla Hegarty of UCD on the housing implications, and Bernard Joyce of the Irish Traveller Movement. Now, we've been delighted with the response to these pieces, and the last three episodes have been the fastest downloaded of all 20 episodes of Social Justice Matters that we've uploaded so far. So we really appreciate the support. The big news in politics and policymaking this week was the release by Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil of a draft document that might provide a framework for programme for government negotiations. This document contains a number of positive aspirations, as well as plenty of cause for concern. Now, I sat down with Social Justice Ireland CEO Dr. Sean Healy, remotely, as per the times in which we live, to analyse this document for our podcast. And a full analysis in the form of a 15-page booklet is available to download for free from our website, socialjustice.ie. We hope you find this episode useful. Be sure to check back again soon for more Social Justice Matters. So I'm here with, at a safe social distance, it should be stated, with the CEO of Social Justice Ireland, Sean Healy. Sean, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Glad to be here, as always.
The main issue for those of us in the policy sphere at the moment is, of course, the negotiations for a possible programme for government involving Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, and maybe one or two other groupings in the Dáil. And Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, just 2 days ago, released a document which is intended to form the basis for those negotiations. They refer to it as a draft document, which might lead, I suppose, to a more comprehensive program for government at some point. Now, I think it's important that our listeners are aware of some of the intricacies within that document. So what's your immediate reaction to it? I mean, would you say it's a broadly positive piece, or is there pieces within there that would concern you?
I think the most important thing to realise at the beginning is that it isn't a national programme for government, that it's basically a framework document. So a lot of the criticism that it's vague or it doesn't actually contain concrete proposals, I think, are just unfair to the document. It's only at stage one, if you like, of a takeoff of a programme for government document. So what I see in it is a framework that puts a new social contract and a focus on the well-being of Irish people right there at the heart of the framework. And I think that's a positive development. And so too is the recognition in the document that there should be no going back to the old ways of doing things. And they say that, and I think that's good. I think there's a number of other things that are positive there. For example, it recognises the need for new, credible quality of life measures, that we shouldn't just be measuring progress on the basis of economic growth or whatever, that we need another way of measuring it that is more holistic and comprehensive. And these are many things, many of these things are issues that Social Justice Ireland has been arguing for quite a number of years. On the other side, there would be things that are problematic as we look at them, ones that would cause us concern, I think, in Social Justice Ireland. And I think for example, the failure to give any priority to the elimination of poverty is a critically important issue. The failure to give sufficient visibility to the issue of equality is another one. And these are kind of important issues in terms of shaping the future, because it seems to me that the elimination of poverty should be at one of the top items on the agenda of any government in one of the countries of, we're one of the richest countries in the world. We have the resources to eliminate poverty more or less, and we're not making a great fist of it. We brought it down, and we're kind of very happy, I suppose, at one level that we are able to say we're close to the European average or even exceeding the European average in some cases. That's not good enough in the context of Irish people. I think they want poverty eliminated, if at all possible, go certainly close to it. Now, there's another thing in the agreement I think that's very good is the issue around housing, healthcare and climate being given priority. These are critical issues, and the fact that they're recognised as critical and that they need serious investment is good within the framework document. But of course, what impact any of this has on those issues or any other issue depends totally on what actually is included in the final agreement, what policy proposals, what initiatives are proposed, what initiatives are to be developed within the period of government of that's going to be covered by this program, and the program that flows from this framework. And I suppose they're the critical issues. If you go back to the issue of social contract, Eamon, you're well aware of the situation of the social contract. But I think a lot of people are not that conscious of the social contract most of the time. It's kind of an unwritten type of agreement between the citizen and the state. It's understood almost subliminally that the state will provide certain supports and guarantees and levels and initiatives that provide some kind of a decent standard of living and protection and so on. And on the other side, then the citizen agrees to act in a particular way, in a responsible way, and to participate in society and so on. And I think what we're looking at with the current COVID-19 crisis is a realization among a lot of people that they want a different kind of social contract when all of this is over. And I think that that's kind of very important, and we need to think about that. And I think it's important, for example, to think in terms of the kind of basic rights that would be supported, if you like, in a social contract, in the new world, if you like, post-corona virus.
I think there's a broad consensus that certainly amongst media commentators that there is no way of going. There's no way we can go back to the old way of doing things. That people are going to expect something different from the society that emerges. I suppose the question that a lot of people would have, insofar as they might think so deeply about it, is how do we decide what that's going to look like? I mean, the broad outline has been drawn, perhaps, in this document, and the acknowledgement that a new social contract is necessary is very important and very welcome. But aside from broad aims like solving the housing crisis, bringing in a single-tier healthcare system, all motherhood and apple pie kind of stuff, how do we decide what the actual new social contract looks like?
I think there's two kinds of levels that question works at. One is that we have to have some kind of a decision-making process. We have some kind of a process of participation that engages the citizen in an ongoing dialogue about what kind of social contract the citizen wants to see. And I think that one of the things that's not dealt with properly in the framework document is the need for a genuine social dialogue. There's a few references to it. One in particular that would concern me sees only the engagement of employers, organizations, and trade unions in such a dialogue. That's not acceptable to me under any heading. I think we have to face up to the fact that one of the things we need is to engage all citizens in the decision-making processes that affect them. And certainly the shape of the economy and the shape of the social contract and so on impact on all citizens. So we need a proper social dialogue or social partnership process. It doesn't have to be called social partnership. It doesn't even have to be the exact same as before. But it must involve not just employers and trade unions, but it must also involve the community and voluntary sector. It must involve farming organizations. It must involve environmental organizations and groupings and those sectors in society, so that we get a broad sweep of the kinds of people who are engaged in shaping our society, so that they actually have a voice there. Now, the other piece, the other level that at which the question works is to ask ourselves, what would people basically expect in a basic social contract? And it seems to me that there's quite a lot of things maybe that people might like to see in there, but that there's at least seven things that are absolutely basic people would see. And for example, the first one that I would put there is that everybody should have enough income to live life with dignity. The second thing would be that everybody should have meaningful work. The third one is that we have access to basic healthcare. that we have access, that every citizen has access to relevant education, that every citizen has access to appropriate accommodation, that every citizen has the opportunity for real participation in shaping the decisions that affect them. And finally, that the seventh one is that there is an expectation that the cultures are respected, particularly minority cultures are actually respected. So it seems to me that income, work, healthcare, education, accommodation, participation, and cultural respect, these are kind of seven basics. They're not the only rights, no, under any circumstances, of course not. But if you were to ask the general public what they would see as essentials in a social contract, I think all seven of those would actually appear there with huge support from the general public, from the ordinary citizen. And I think one of the things that we should be looking at is how do we put programs in place to deliver on those outcomes, if you like. And it isn't that we have to deliver them all in the first 5 minutes or the first year of a program, but that there is there has to be a recognition that this is what the government is working towards, and that it's working towards it in a serious way, not on the idea that we'll do that in 100 years' time when we reach some kind of utopian nirvana or something. That's not acceptable. It has to be something that is consciously engaged with and is being engaged with. And for example, that's one of the reasons I would be quite disappointed that the framework document produced by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael doesn't actually contain a commitment to deal with poverty, because I think we need to get to a point where the elimination of poverty is a goal in policy, and the necessary steps are taken to achieve that goal. And we have made big strides in reducing poverty, but then we hit serious bumps in the road. For example, in budget 2020, government gave no increase whatsoever in the basic social welfare rate, and the result is that group were said to be the only group in Irish society, people who are depending on the basic social welfare rates, were to be the only people, this is before coronavirus came, they were going to be the only group in Irish society that would see their standard of living fall in 2020. Now, to me, that is completely unacceptable and runs completely counter to the idea of a social contract and a government being serious about tackling the issues that need to be delivered as part of a social contract. So within the framework document, there should be a commitment to substantially reduce poverty, especially child poverty, and specific concrete targets and actions and initiatives to reach that. But we also need to face up to, and this is going to be a bigger issue after coronavirus is over, or at least has been controlled, and that is the issue of work. Because this is working at two levels as well, because there's a lot of people now working from home who see that there's a certain advantage in spending maybe a certain amount of time working away from the office, and I think there's going to be a certain amount of requirement for that. On the other side, there's also a recognition that maybe there's other types of work that we haven't recognized properly or haven't given due respect to. Work in the community, work in caring. Look at the huge work that's being done in caring, and that's so much highlighted now, right at this very moment with the virus situation. And the work that is done by carers isn't respected at all and isn't remunerated in any serious way. So I think we need to be thinking about that as a society. Shouldn't we be paying carers for the care work that they do? Because that care work is actually very supportive, whether it's of children or whether it's of older people or whether it's of people with disabilities or people with other care needs. A third area that has become very prominent is the whole issue of healthcare. And certainly there's a very strong rejection, I think, among most people of the idea, among most citizens, that there should be there's a rejection of the two-tier healthcare system. And what we have is a situation, or have had up to now, is that basically you got a basic kind of health package, but you could jump the queue and go to the front of the queue if you had the money to do so and buy the insurance and so on. I think there's a recognition now that that's not the right way to do healthcare, that we need to do it on the basis of need. And that all the whole healthcare system needs to be integrated to deliver it in that way. That's doable. It costs a certain amount of money. Up to 3 months ago, we were basically saying we can't give any more money to health. And since then, we've given an additional 2 billion euro to health. So like what we were saying then is obviously untrue. But the reality, of course, is that $2 billion, it would have been much better if it were done in a, if it had been done in a structured way earlier on. It wasn't. It was done in a very rushed way. So there's a lot of work to be done to do the reform that's required and the restructuring that's required. But certainly we're down the road towards a one-tier healthcare system, and I would be very positive about that. Another variation, actually, and the framework document is good on this. It's the whole issue of education. And that there's a need for education, there's a need for recognizing that people have a right to access to relevant education. And there's good stuff in here about adult literacy in the document and so on, and a recognition of the need to fund, to provide more funding for adult literacy. But what isn't there is, and that needs to be added, is lifelong learning. Because one of the things that we're realizing is that the world of work is changing and the world in which people live all the time is changing. All you've got to think about is how people, older people, are communicating with their grandchildren today in this whole corona world. And they're using technology that they probably never even dreamt about. And yet they've had to educate themselves in accessing that and in being able to use it and so on. And that's just a small little thing about lifelong learning, but there's a whole lot of other stuff as well. The big issue that is recognized, one of the real big issues recognized in the document, is the whole issue of housing and the recognition that we're not doing well enough on housing. We need a commitment to appropriate accommodation for every man, woman and child in the society. And hubs and hotel rooms and all this kind of stuff, these are not appropriate accommodation.
Would it concern you at all that some of the stuff, particularly the headline issues, housing, healthcare, climate, the idea that we're going to tackle family homelessness now, the idea in relation to climate that, say, we're going to, quote, set new carbon reduction targets, identifying and implementing early significant changes and underpinned with a clear roadmap to delivery. I mean, a lot of this stuff is sort of rehashed from previous aspirations and policies that have been around, in some case, for a decade. Does it worry you that this is just repeating previous intentions with no real concrete proposals as to how any of this is going to be achieved? And if it was possible to do this, why haven't we done it already?
You're absolutely right, Eamon. Like, you've hit the nail on the head in the fact that we've had these kind of aspirations on a regular basis, but we actually haven't delivered them in terms of policy initiatives and investment. And I think what we need to be very careful about here as we assess a new program for government is that the aspirations contained in this framework are actually worked through in the program with specific concrete proposals. If you take the housing one, for example, I think the current schemes that disproportionately benefit those who don't need assistance in the first place in buying a house or a home should be closed as soon as possible. There's stuff out there that shouldn't be prioritized the way it is. Likewise, Ireland needs to replace the current local property tax with a site value tax. We've argued this from day one. The current local property tax is not really a proper tax for this kind of situation. And we need to improve mechanisms for penalising land hoarding. And at least there's work being done in that, and there has been progress over the last, slow, but at least it's progress. And that needs to be speeded up. And it also needs to be implemented and enforced, that people basically have a choice. They either use the land that they have or they're going to pay a serious penalty for hoarding it. And another variation might be the windfall gains tax that was introduced after the crash and then that Michael Noonan removed in the budget, I think it was 2015. That's the windfall gains tax. Like, just at the point where people were starting to make windfall gains again, he eliminates the tax that was supposed to catch that. And I think that's kind of codology, really. Like, it should have been dealt with, should have been left in place. And certainly now, it isn't too late, reintroduce it. That's the bottom line in that. So I think the key issue in all of that, of course, is that all of the things I'm talking about are basically trying to work towards increasing the supply of social housing. We've just got that wrong over the last few decades. We've basically depended on the private market. The private market does not deliver altruistic goals. It basically works for profit. We've got to recognize that the state has to become seriously involved in the provision of social housing. Different ways of doing that. It doesn't mean that the state itself has to actually build them, but it has to be the driving force, and it has to be the organizing force, and it has to put in the investment to do it. If we don't do that, we won't be able to deliver appropriate accommodation for all our citizens for many a long day into the future, and that simply would not be acceptable. So I think that's very, very important that concrete initiatives, concrete policy proposals are actually put into the final version of the programme for government to spell out how the aspirations that they would have been aspired to before and noted before, how are these actually going to be delivered? And at what point? I think that it's important to spell out when these will be delivered, how they'll be delivered, the scale at which they'll be delivered. For example, we've had the initiative on social housing that's been out there, rebuilding Ireland, not just social housing, all housing. And from day one, we have been critical of that because, not because it wasn't a good idea, the plan itself, but the fact that it was nowhere near the scale that was required to deal with the challenges that were out there. And the tragedy was that an analysis done by our colleague Colette Bennett last November shows that in actual fact, all five pillars were being missed. And none of the five pillars were actually being delivered at that point. And so that's the five pillars contained within the Rebuilding Ireland's strategy. So it's not good enough even to have a strategy and something like that. It's got to spell out where to, like, what's the level of outcome we're going to get year by year, the output, to make sure that we're actually meeting targets. What are the targets and how are we going to meet them? Not to have targets that we miss, but like targets that are on the scale required and are going to be delivered on. And I think that's critically important in housing. But of course, it's also critically important in health, and it's also critically important in areas like climate that you mentioned as well.
I think probably one of the items contained within the document that certainly Social Justice Ireland would welcome, and that probably a great number of other civil society organisations would welcome as well, is the acknowledgement of the need to move towards a living wage over the period of the next government. And also a lot has been made about the fact that this COVID-19 unemployment payment being set at €350 a week is a tacit acknowledgement of the fact that the old rate of €203 a week was never really sufficient in the first place. And many would say that government will have to act now in order to do that. I mean, if they manage to tackle those two things, would that essentially solve the issue of meeting people's right to an income that allows them to live life with dignity?
Almost, but not quite. I think there's going to be people still falling through cracks that needs to be addressed. I'll come to that in a second. First of all, the living wage commitment is very, very welcome. That they would commit to a living wage over the lifetime of the next government, it really warmly welcome that. The interesting thing from that, from our perspective in Social Justice Ireland, is that Social Justice Ireland is a member of the living wage technical group that measures the level that the living wage should be at. And we use tremendous work that has been done by the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice, where they have identified the minimally essential standard of living levels. So we've been able to use a lot of that, their material, to work out a very fair and solid approach towards this, calculating a living wage. And I think that a living wage is certainly doable over the period of a 5-year period of government. So I really warmly welcome that. The second piece that you mentioned, it was very interesting to find that within a matter of days, it wasn't even a week, at the start of this corona crisis, when they brought in their payment of €203, for people who are becoming unemployed as a result of the virus. They suddenly realize this isn't nearly enough for people to live life with any kind of dignity, and they upped it immediately to 350. Now, that's a very, very interesting jump, because that's an astronomical jump, as anybody could see. So the interesting thing is, if 203 euro a week is not enough for the people currently becoming unemployed, then it's obviously not enough for those who are already unemployed, or were already unemployed when this started. So there's an acknowledgement by government, and I think by all the political parties, that 203 euro a week simply isn't enough. So social welfare needs to be benchmarked, it needs to be increased, and the benchmark needs to be somewhere at the poverty line. But to actually have a foolproof system in which everybody would have enough income to live life with dignity, we need to go beyond this. Why? Because this system that we have has too many holes in it, and too many holes in the safety net, if you like, and the danger is that people will fall through. It's not appropriate. The current welfare system is not appropriate for the 21st century. We need a system that is appropriate for the 21st century, and universal basic income is such a system. And I think it would be very, very good to see a commitment to looking at the introduction of a universal basic income and how that might actually work, and how it might sit, for example, with universal basic services, so that the other areas we're talking about in work and healthcare and education and maybe accommodation, that these would also be seen as universal basic services, and put that with universal basic income. And that's the kind of package, I think, that the vast majority of citizens would be positive about and would like to see, because it would give them some kind of assurance that when things really went wrong, there was a floor, a sort of a level below which they would not be allowed to fall. And I think that would be a critically important initiative that would have a huge difference. So I would love to see the programme for government contain something along the lines of a serious study and maybe a pilot of moving towards the testing a universal basic income. And as I say, make it sit with the ultimate aim being to have a universal basic income together with universal basic services to provide that kind of floor underneath the citizen, guaranteed by the state. And that would be the kind of solidarity that would make a huge difference and would, in fact, underpin very strongly a social contract into the future.
So I get the sense that you're in broad agreement with a lot of what the document contains. But one of the criticisms that's been leveled at it in the last couple of days is the fact that it's scant in detail as to how you actually pay for these things. And it's all very well setting big goals like solving the housing crisis, bringing in that universal healthcare system, and even bringing in a system of basic income. But they're very expensive policies, a lot of these. I mean, how do you go about funding this, keeping in mind that although our borrowing costs are next to nothing at the moment, this does have to be paid for eventually?
I think that this is one of the weaknesses in the document. At one level, maybe it's understandable at this stage of the development of the document, because it's simply a framework. And there is, I assume, an understanding that among the political parties involved that these things have to be paid for. I liked and would welcome the assertion contained in the document that all decisions with regard to national finances must be fair and sustainable, because I think that was an issue that wasn't part of the agreement that we came up with 10 years ago after the crash at the end of the Celtic Tiger. I think there's a need to fully mobilize budgetary and monetary resources. That's a key issue. And I think we need to think in terms of how that might be done. And one of the areas that Social Justice Ireland has been arguing in favor of for a long time is that we need to increase Ireland's total tax take, not its income tax take, its total tax take, and that we need to move towards the European average. We mightn't reach the European average, but we need to move towards it. And the reason for that is that most Irish people aspire to the level of services and infrastructure that would characterize Western European countries. These are our peer countries that we measure ourselves against and that we want to emulate. But we can't seek to emulate them unless we actually go close to the kinds of levels of tax take that they have as well. It's simply not possible to deliver on Western European levels of infrastructure and social services with American levels of taxation. You either have one or the other. If you have American levels of taxation, you have very poor infrastructure, you have very poor social services, and you're very much dependent on being able to pay for the services yourself. And we see that at the moment in the American healthcare system, for example. But so much it's across much else of their services as well. We, I think, in Europe have a different approach to services, and I would certainly be much happier with the European social model. However, it has, like the European social model has to be paid for, and I think we need to have that upfront. And part of it, from the Irish government point of view, needs to be a naming of the need to raise the overall tax take. You don't have to raise income tax necessarily to do that. There's a lot of different ways of doing it. In the same way that there's a lot of different ways, we'll say, of funding a basic income system or whatever. It doesn't mean increasing tax, income tax. There's different ways of doing it. But I think it's very, very important that that we recognise that Ireland's total tax take is low by European standards, and that the total tax take needs to rise. And we've, as I said, we've been pointing out ways of doing this for quite some time. I think that would make a big difference in getting acceptance for the changes that are required to deliver a social contract along the lines that we're talking about. It would be real social dialogue that we mentioned already. And I think it's very important to involve all stakeholders and not just some of the stakeholders in creating the consensus of what Ireland's social contract should look like and how it is to be achieved. And I think one of the things that the final draft of the programme for government should contain is a commitment to have a real social dialogue stroke social partnership kind of approach that involves all sectors of Irish society in a real way and on an ongoing basis, not on a one-off basis, but on an ongoing basis, and that participation is real and that their views are taken into account and that their views are listened to and considered, not necessarily always accepted, because very often there can be issues that people are not aware of or whatever, but at least there's a dialogue, people can contribute to the dialogue, and that they feel that their voices are actually being heard, that they have real participation in shaping the decisions that affect them. I think that's a critically important issue in getting societal acceptance for a new social contract, for a new way of doing things, for leaving the old ways behind, and for building a better and more fair and just future for everybody.
It sounds like you're very positive on the aspirations contained within. Maybe there needs to be a few omissions corrected and a little bit more detail on how we pay for it. But broadly speaking, I think it's certainly a step in the right direction.
I think that's a fair comment. I think it's a step in the right direction. The measure of whether or not it is of any consequence at the end of the day will be whether or not the detailed policy proposals are actually included in a final programme for government. That's the critical issue. If they are not included, then this is just aspirations again. And, you know, as you called it already, apple pie and motherhood stuff. We need to get beyond that. We need to have concrete proposals to how to get ourselves into a situation where everybody has enough income to live life with dignity, has access to meaningful work, has basic healthcare, has relevant education or access to it, has appropriate accommodation, has real participation and is listened to, and has their culture respected. And I think they're the kinds of issues, they're the kinds of thing, components, if you like, that the social contract should have, and that I think most Irish people would be happy to see in a social contract, but they have to be actually lived out. They have to be not just aspired to, but actually worked for day by day, year by year, budget by budget.
I think that's a great place to end it. Sean, thanks very much for taking the time this morning.
You're more than welcome as always, Eamon.
Thanks for listening. Hopefully you found this episode useful. You can read more of our analysis of the draft document on our website, socialjustice.ie. Our 15-page response is available for free, and we cover each of the 10 areas laid out in the Fine Gael Fianna Fáil document, pointing out the positives, the areas for concern, the key omissions, and the policies that will be needed to achieve the goals laid out within. Until next time, stay safe.